Ever feel like you only know one side of the story? Well, we're tackling that today. We're diving into the many different ways people view Jesus. I mean, from the traditional Christian perspective to some you've probably never even heard of.
It's mind-blowing how one figure can spark such really different interpretations,
Yeah.
throughout history and across cultures.
It really is. And our guide for this journey is Dr. Robert Newman and his lectures on the Synoptic Gospels.
Yes.
And he doesn't hold back exploring how various groups view the historical Jesus, even those who flat out deny he existed.
Yeah, Newman's approach is perfect for our deep dive today.
I think so too.
He lays out the facts and lets us grapple with the implications, which can be a little uncomfortable sometimes.
Right.
Hey, isn't that how we grow up?
Exactly. So to set the stage, let's start with the viewpoint. Most of us are probably familiar with the traditional Christian perspective of Jesus as both fully God and fully human.
And I think it's important to acknowledge right off the bat that this is a complex theological concept with centuries of debate behind it.
Right.
We won't get into all the theological weeds today, but it's crucial to understand that this belief in Jesus's dual nature is the bedrock of Christianity.
Got it. But what happens when we step outside that traditional framework? Newman dives into some alternative views that see Jesus as only human, starting with atheism.
Okay,
Yeah.
atheism by its very definition denies the existence of any deity.
Right.
So naturally, they wouldn't view Jesus as divine. Some atheists even go so far as to claim Jesus was a fictional character altogether.
Really?
Yeah, might sound radical, but this was a common view within historical communist thought.
A fictional Jesus. I'm already seeing how this deep dive is going to challenge some assumptions. Okay, so if atheism denies Jesus's divinity, where does Islam fit into this? They believe in God, but their concept is quite different from the Christian one, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Islam is strictly monotheistic, believing in one God, Allah.
Okay.
Now, they do view Jesus as a prophet, a very important one, but they don't consider him divine in the way Christians do.
Okay.
What's fascinating is that the Quran, their holy book, states that Jesus was born of a virgin
Oh,
and
wow.
performed miracles, things they don't even attribute to Muhammad, their central prophet.
Hold on. They believe in the virgin birth A&D miracles, but not that he's God. That's a fascinating distinction.
It is. And it gets even more intriguing. Islam also teaches that Jesus didn't actually die on the cross.
What?
Instead, they believe he was raised up to heaven and someone else was crucified in his place.
Oh, wow.
It's a completely different take on the crucifixion and resurrection narrative.
Wow, talk about a plot twist. Okay, so we've got atheism saying he wasn't real, Islam saying he was a prophet but not God. Now, Newman shifts gears to perspectives that emerged from within Christianity itself, starting with old liberalism.
Old liberalism, which gained traction in the 18th and 19th centuries, essentially rejects miracles as impossible.
Okay.
So they reinterpreted the biblical accounts of Jesus through that lens.
So how did they view Jesus if they didn't believe in miracles?
They generally saw him as a highly ethical teacher, someone with profound moral insights, but ultimately human.
Okay.
The idea was that early Christians, especially those who weren't Jewish, misunderstood Jesus and elevated him to divine status.
Right.
They saw his death as a powerful example of self-sacrifice, but his resurrection, purely symbolic of spiritual resurrection.
No physical rising from the dead, some more of a metaphorical transformation. That's a pretty significant departure from traditional belief.
Then there's neo-orthodoxy, which Newman describes as a development of old liberalism.
Right. Neo-Orthodoxy also tends to reject miracles, but they shift the focus from the Jesus of history to the Christ of faith. In other words, the historical details of Jesus' life become less important than the personal meaning and impact of his teachings. It sounds like they're trying to find a way to hold on to faith while still embracing a worldview that doesn't allow for the supernatural.
Exactly. It's about finding relevance and meaning in the message, even if you question the historical accuracy of the events.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now buckle up because Newman then takes us into some groups that do view Jesus as divine, but not in the way traditional Christianity does. First up, Jehovah's Witnesses. I know they have some unique beliefs, but I'm not entirely familiar with them. Fill me in.
Jehovah's Witnesses, like Muslims, place a strong emphasis on monotheism.
Okay.
They believe in God, but for them, Jesus is not the Almighty God.
Okay.
He's not equal to God the Father, complicated. But one way to understand their view is to think of Jesus as a sort of reincarnation, though they don't use that term of the Archangel Michael.
Wait, a reincarnation of an angel. Now, that's not something you hear every day.
Right.
How do they explain that?
They're trying to make sense of the biblical passages that describe Jesus as God's agent in creation. For Jehovah's Witnesses, Jesus was born of a virgin, performed miracles, and died on the cross. But they believe his body dissolved in the tomb, and he'll return one day to establish an earthly kingdom for his followers.
Okay.
It's a unique interpretation, to say the least.
Definitely a lot to unpack there.
Yeah.
Okay, so what about Mormonism?
Right.
They also have a distinct view of Jesus, right?
They do. It's actually kind of layered.
Okay.
Their Book of Mormon presents a relatively orthodox view of Jesus, pretty similar to traditional Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
But their later scriptures, like the Doctrine and Covenants, introduce this radical concept. Humans can become gods, just like Jesus and God the Father.
So in Mormonism, Jesus wasn't always God. He was human first and then achieved godhood.
That's right. They believe that Jesus was once a man who, through his spiritual journey and ascension, achieved godhood.
Wow.
And this idea of humans becoming gods is central to Mormon theology. They believe that Jesus' death saves us from original sin. But our progression towards a higher level of heaven depends on our own efforts and adherence to their teachings.
Right.
It's a very works-oriented approach to salvation.
Wow. So much to think about. Okay, Newman also touches on the New Age movement, which is pretty diverse in itself.
Mm-hmm.
How do they generally view Jesus?
New Age thought often draws from Eastern religions and philosophies.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to see Jesus as one of many ascended masters who achieved a high level of spiritual enlightenment.
So not necessarily unique in his divinity, but more like one of many who reached that level of spiritual awareness.
Exactly. He's a powerful spiritual figure, but not the only one. In the New Age view, there are many paths to spiritual enlightenment, and you too can potentially achieve a similar state through various practices and techniques.
Right.
It's a very individualistic and experiential approach into spirituality.
Okay, so we've gone from Jesus as fully God to a prophet to an enlightened master, and even the idea that he never existed. It's incredible how many different interpretations there are. But now we're about to enter a whole new territory.
You're right. Newman calls the next set of views allegedly historical attempts to reconstruct the historical Jesus, often with the underlying assumption that miracles are impossible.
Right.
And that's where things get really interesting.
Okay, lead the way. I'm ready to dive into these historical reconstructions and see what they reveal.
All right. All right, let's dive into these allegedly historical views, starting with the deists.
Okay.
Imagine a god who's like a master watchmaker. They create this intricate clock, the universe, set it in motion, and then step back. No meddling, no miracles, just pure observation.
So for deists, the idea of a god who actively intervenes in the world, performing miracles, is just completely off the table.
Exactly. Miracles would contradict their view of a hands-off deity.
Okay.
Now enter Herman Samuel Ramaris, a scholar from the 18th century whose writings really shook things up. His Wolfenbüttel Fragments, published after his death, presented a very controversial take on Jesus.
What made his work so controversial? Was he also a deist?
Not quite. Ramaris actually argued that Jesus was a political revolutionary, a Jewish messiah figure who aimed to liberate Israel from Roman rule. But when his movement failed, his disciples, according to Ramaris, concocted the resurrection story to launch a new religion.
Wow, so he's saying the resurrection was a fabrication. That must have caused quite a stir back in the 1770s when it was published.
Oh, absolutely. It was a direct challenge to the core beliefs of Christianity. What's also interesting is that Ramaris dismissed the New Testament epistles as reliable sources, a trend that would continue with some of these other historical reconstructions.
So it's like they're cherry-picking which parts of the biblical narrative they find credible and which parts they discard. Okay, what about rationalism? Newman mentions that they approach the Gospels from a very different angle.
Right. Rationalists believe in reason and logic above all else. Heinrich Paulus, a key figure in this movement, believed the miracles described in the Gospels did happen.
Okay.
But he attempted to explain them away as natural events that were simply misunderstood by those who witnessed them.
Misunderstood miracles. Okay, I have to hear some examples. How do you explain away something like walking on water?
Well, according to Paulus, Jesus wasn't actually walking on water, but on a hidden sandbar or very close to the shore. The disciples, in their astonishment, simply misinterpreted what they saw. Or take the feeding of the 5,000. Paula suggested that most of the people actually had food hidden away, and when the little boy offered his lunch, it shamed them into sharing, creating the illusion of a miraculous multiplication.
I have to admit, that's pretty clever. But what about the resurrection? How could he possibly explain that away with logic and reason?
Paulus proposed that Jesus didn't actually die on the cross, but fell into a coma. The cool tomb, the spices used for burial, they revived him. And then conveniently, an earthquake rolled away the stone, making it appear as if he had risen from the dead. He even went so far as to suggest that Jesus, badly injured from the crucifixion, later died in secret, explaining why he eventually disappeared.
Wow, he had an explanation for everything. But even if his ideas seem a bit far-fetched to us now, he was clearly trying to reconcile the biblical accounts with his own rational worldview.
Absolutely. And even though his attempts to rationalize miracles were ridiculed even by other liberal scholars, his work was influential in spreading these kinds of interpretations within Christian circles. He paved the way for more liberal forms of Christianity.
So we're seeing a gradual shift away from the supernatural and towards a more human-centered view of Jesus. Now, what about idealism? How did they approach the question of who Jesus was?
For idealists, mind and ideas are the fundamental reality. They're more focused on the realm of thought than the material world. David Friedrich Strauss, a key figure in this movement, argued that the Gospels are filled with myth, not in the sense of being false, but as timeless religious truths expressed through the language of historical narrative.
So he's saying that the stories themselves might not be literally true, but they convey deeper symbolic truths. That's a pretty nuanced approach.
Exactly. For Strauss, the real message lay in these deeper truths, not the historical accuracy of the events themselves. For example, he saw the concept of Jesus' divinity as a mythical expression of the idea that humanity and divinity are ultimately one, not a literal historical fact.
So he's more interested in the philosophical and theological ideas behind the stories than the stories themselves. Did he also try to explain away the miracles?
No, unlike Paulus, he didn't feel the need to rationalize the miracles, because for him, the historical events were secondary. What mattered were the underlying ideas and the impact they had on people's beliefs and understanding of the world.
It sounds like he was trying to bridge the gap between faith and reason, finding a way to make sense of the Gospels in a more philosophical way.
Yes, and his work, though controversial, had a significant impact on later scholars like Rudolf Bultmann, who tried to demythologize the Gospels. It's a complex process, but essentially it's an attempt to separate the core message of the Gospels from those mythical elements they saw as products of the time and culture in which they were written.
So strip away the supernatural elements and see what's left, kind of like peeling back the layers of an onion to get to the core.
That's a great analogy. It's a way of making the Christian message more palatable for a modern scientific worldview. But as you can imagine, it's a highly debated approach. Now let's shift gears again to Romanticism, which emphasized emotions and intuition over pure reason, a sharp contrast to the Enlightenment's focus on logic.
Right, so we're talking about feelings and intuition as valid ways of knowing, not just cold, hard facts. How did the Romantics approach Jesus?
Well, Ernest Renan, the key figure in this movement, wrote a very popular book called Life of Jesus, in which he portrayed Jesus's life unfolding in three distinct phases: the ethical teacher, the revolutionary, and the martyr.
Okay, break that down for me. How did he envision each of those phases?
Renan believed that Jesus began as a gentle, optimistic teacher, spreading a message of love and attracting devoted followers. In this phase, he performed no miracles except perhaps some psychosomatic healings where people's belief in his power led to actual physical improvement.
So kind of like an early version of a self-help guru, someone who inspired people to tap into their own inner healing potential.
Yes, in a way. But then, according to Renan, things took a turn when Jesus encountered resistance from the religious authorities in Jerusalem. He became more of a revolutionary figure, even resorting to staged miracles to gain support for his movement.
Wait, staged miracles? That's a pretty radical claim. How does Renan explain that shift?
He suggests that Jesus felt pressured to prove his messianic claims, but ultimately he realized that his movement couldn't succeed. That's when he entered the martyr phase, accepting his fate and establishing rituals like baptism and communion to ensure the survival of his teachings.
So he transitioned from a peaceful teacher to a revolutionary, and finally to a martyr figure giving his life for his beliefs. That's a pretty dramatic arc.
It is. And Renan even suggests that Mary Magdalene's vision of the resurrected Jesus was a hallucination fueled by her grief and longing for him. It's a very human emotional interpretation of the resurrection story. His book was incredibly popular and helped to introduce this idea that our aesthetic preferences, what we find beautiful or appealing, can actually be a guide to truth.
That's a fascinating concept, beauty as a measure of truth. It makes you think about how our emotions and intuitions can shape our beliefs and understandings. Okay, so we've covered deism, rationalism, idealism, and romanticism. What's next in Newman's exploration of these allegedly historical views?
He then delves into skepticism, which takes doubt to a whole new level.
Okay.
Skeptics question the very possibility of reconstructing Jesus' life accurately.
Yeah.
Wilhelm Rade, a German scholar, embodies this approach.
Okay, so if he's so skeptical, how did Reed even approach the Gospels? Did he just dismiss them entirely?
Not entirely. He focused on what's called the messianic secret in the Gospel of Mark.
Okay.
It's the idea that Jesus instructed his disciples to keep his identity as the Messiah a secret. Reed argued that this secrecy motif was actually Mark's invention, a way of explaining why Jesus, if he truly was the Messiah, wasn't widely recognized during his lifetime.
Interesting. So he's essentially saying that Mark shaped the narrative to fit his own theological agenda, not necessarily to accurately reflect historical events. That's a pretty bold claim.
It is. And this skepticism towards the Gospels led to the rise of what's called form criticism, championed by scholars like Rudolf Bultmann, who we talked about earlier.
Right, right.
Remember, he was the one who tried to demythologize the Gospels.
Right, right. So by the early 20th century, these skeptical scholars had essentially cast doubt on the reliability of all four Gospels. John was considered too theological and written too late. Matthew and Luke were seen as reliant on Mark, and Mark was deemed unreliable by Reed. It seems like they really dismantled the traditional narrative.
They did.
Yeah.
This wave of skepticism actually put a stop to scholarly attempts to write biographies of Jesus for several decades.
Wow, that's a pretty significant impact. So what happened next? Did anyone try to pick up the pieces and find a new way to understand the historical Jesus?
Yes, thankfully. In the 1950s, a movement known as the Second Quest for the Historical Jesus emerged.
Okay.
These scholars, while still skeptical of miracles, weren't satisfied with the extreme skepticism of Bultmann and his followers. They wanted to find new ways to glean historical insights from the Gospels, even if they acknowledged their limitations.
So they were trying to find a middle ground between blind faith and total skepticism. It sounds like a delicate balancing act.
It was. And this second quest eventually led to the third quest, which is still ongoing today.
Wow.
There's a renewed interest in understanding the historical Jesus using more sophisticated methods and taking into account a wider range of historical and cultural evidence.
That's encouraging. It sounds like the quest for understanding Jesus is far from over. Now, I'm really curious to hear about some of these more recent attempts to make sense of who he was. Newman mentions some intriguing figures and movements from the post-World War II era. What can you tell me about them?
All right, let's unpack some of these more recent interpretations, starting with the post-Bultmannians.
Okay.
These scholars emerged in the wake of Rudolf Bultmann's radical demythologizing project.
Right.
They were still skeptical of miracles, but they wanted to find a more historically grounded picture of Jesus, even if it meant challenging some of Bultmann's conclusions.
So they were still operating within that skeptical framework, but maybe trying to find a more nuanced understanding of Jesus within those parameters?
Precisely. They were interested in Jesus' self-understanding, how he saw himself and his mission.
Mm-hmm.
But their methods were still quite minimalist.
Okay.
Basically, they tossed out anything in the Gospels that could be attributed to either Jewish or early Christian influence.
Sure.
What they were left with, what they considered dissonant material, was what they believed could be authentic to Jesus.
Dissonant material. I'm not sure I follow. Could you elaborate on that a bit?
Sure. Imagine you're trying to figure out what a composer's original melody was, but you only have access to sheet music that's been copied and rearranged over centuries.
Okay.
You'd look for those notes or chords that seem out of place.
Right.
The ones that don't quite fit the overall harmony.
Right.
Those dissonant elements might be clues to the original composition.
Okay.
The post-Bultmannians applied a similar approach to the Gospels, looking for those sayings or actions of Jesus that seemed to clash with the broader Jewish or Christian context.
Okay, that makes sense. So it's like they're trying to filter out later interpretations and get back to the raw essence of Jesus's message. But did this approach actually yield any new insights?
Surprisingly, yes. They came to some conclusions that really challenged the traditional liberal view of Jesus.
Like what?
For instance, they concluded that Jesus saw himself as uniquely inspired by God, even claiming a unique authority, as we see in his cleansing of the temple.
Interesting.
They also found evidence that he spoke of God's grace, a concept often downplayed in liberal circles.
That's fascinating. So even with their skeptical lens, they found hints of a more theologically significant Jesus than many liberals had previously acknowledged. It's like they were uncovering a hidden dimension of his message.
Exactly. And some scholars in this camp, like Hans Conzelman, even recognized that Jesus spoke of both a present and a future kingdom of God, a concept often seen as contradictory in liberal scholarship.
Right.
This already and not yet dimension of the kingdom is a cornerstone of Christian theology.
Already and not yet. Could you unpack that a little for those of us who aren't theology experts?
Sure. It's the idea that the kingdom of God is both a present reality breaking into the world through Jesus' ministry,
okay,
and a future hope, a time when God's reign will be fully realized.
Right.
It's this tension between the now and the not yet that drives the Christian understanding of history and the believer's role in the world.
Mm. Ah, I got it. Thanks for clarifying that. Okay, so the post-Bultmannians were clearly wrestling with some complex ideas, trying to find that middle ground between skepticism and faith.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Newman also mentions some other figures who offer some pretty unorthodox interpretations of Jesus.
Yes.
He brings up something called the Passover plot.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hugh Schoenfield's The Passover Plot, published in 1966, caused quite a stir.
Okay.
Schoenfield, a Jewish scholar familiar with evangelical interpretations of Old Testament prophecy, proposed that Jesus actually orchestrated his entire ministry and death to fulfill those prophecies.
Wait, orchestrated his own death? That sounds like something out of a conspiracy theory.
It does have those elements, but it's rooted in a very close reading of the Gospels.
Okay.
Schoenfield suggested that Jesus, believing he was the Messiah, intentionally provoked it. The authorities faked his death on the cross and planned to reappear later, fulfilling the prophecies of the resurrection.
Okay, I'm trying to wrap my head around this. So in Schoenfield's view, Jesus was intentionally trying to stage manage the whole thing. But why go through all that trouble?
Schoenfield argues that Jesus, facing rejection in Galilee, believed he had to die and rise again to prove his messiahship.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of trusting God for a real resurrection, he came up with this elaborate scheme to fake it, even using a drug-soaked sponge on the cross to simulate death.
Wow, that is a bold interpretation. It's almost like he's portraying Jesus as a master manipulator. But didn't things go wrong in Schoenfield's version of events?
Yes. The plan supposedly unraveled when a Roman soldier pierced Jesus' side with a spear.
Oh, wow.
He was taken down, revived briefly, but ultimately died. And that left his disciples to grapple with the unexpected outcome. Schoenfield even attributes some of the resurrection appearances to a mysterious assistant who was only partially in on the plan.
It's like a biblical thriller with all these twists and turns.
Yeah.
But I can see why this theory would be met with a lot of skepticism, even among those who are open to alternative interpretations.
Definitely. Now hold on to your hat, because if you thought the Passover plot was out there,
mm-hmm.
John Allegro's The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, published in 1970, takes things to a whole new level.
Okay. The title alone has me intrigued and a little apprehensive.
Allegro, a scholar who worked on the Dead Sea Scrolls, put forward this radical theory. Jesus never actually existed, and both Christianity and Judaism as we know them are actually fronts for an ancient, secret mushroom fertility cult.
Hold on, a mushroom cult? Is he serious?
He was completely serious. He argued that the Bible is packed with coded language about hallucinogenic mushrooms and sexual rituals.
What?
He even used his knowledge of ancient languages to try to back up his claims.
Wow, that's next level conspiracy thinking. I can only imagine the reactions he got from the academic community.
It was met with widespread dismissal.
I bet.
Most scholars saw it as completely unfounded.
Right.
But it does show you the vast range of interpretations people have come up with when trying to understand Jesus.
It's like the ancient aliens of biblical scholarship. Okay, back down to earth for a moment. What about Morton Smith and his book, The Secret Gospel? I vaguely remember hearing about that.
Smith, a scholar of early Christianity, claimed to have discovered a letter from Clement of Alexandria, a second century church father.
Okay.
This letter hinted at a longer, more esoteric version of the Gospel of Mark.
A secret Gospel of Mark? That sounds like something out of the Da Vinci Code. What did this supposedly lost version of Mark reveal?
Smith suggested that this longer version portrayed Jesus as a Gnostic magician performing miracles through secret knowledge and engaging in rituals that challenged conventional morality.
A magician Jesus. Okay, now I've heard it all. But is this secret gospel considered authentic?
That's the million-dollar question, and it's where things get very murky. The original document vanished, and many scholars believe it was a modern forgery, possibly even created by Smith himself.
A scholarly hoax. Wow, that would be a major scandal. So the mystery of the secret gospel remains unsolved.
It does. And the debate over its authenticity continues to this day. But let's shift gears to a more recent movement that has gotten a lot of attention, the Jesus Seminar.
Ah, yes, the colored bead people. I've heard about them. They're the ones who vote on the authenticity of Jesus's sayings, right?
That's them. This group of scholars, formed in the 1980s, set out to determine which words attributed to Jesus in the Gospels were actually spoken by him. They developed this system using colored beads to vote on the likelihood of each saying being authentic.
So Redford definitely said it, Pink four probably said it, and so on.
You got it. And their conclusions were pretty shocking to some. They determined that a whopping 82% of the sayings attributed to Jesus in the Gospels were not authentic.
Wow, 82%. That's a huge chunk of the gospel narratives. What were some of their key findings?
They concluded that very few sayings in Mark were authentic, and only one in John even made it to the pink category, meaning probably said it.
Wow.
They also gave the Gospel of Thomas, a non-canonical text, a higher rating for authenticity than both Mark and John.
So they're essentially saying that the Jesus we encounter in the Gospels is largely a creation of the early church, not a reflection of the historical figure.
That's their position, and it's generated a lot of debate and criticism, even among other liberal scholars.
It's definitely a provocative stance. Well, we've covered a lot of ground today, from traditional Christian beliefs to atheism, Islam, liberal Christianity, and even some truly mind-blowing theories. It's been an incredible journey. What strikes you most from all of this?
You know, what fascinates me is how these diverse perspectives, even the ones that seem outlandish, highlight the enduring power and mystery of Jesus.
Yeah.
He continues to captivate and challenge people centuries later, even those who completely reject his divinity. It speaks to the profound depth and complexity of both his person and his message.
I couldn't agree more. It's been a truly thought-provoking deep dive. So what does all this mean for you, the listener? Well, we hope this exploration has given you a glimpse into the vast and often surprising world of perspectives on Jesus.
We encourage you to keep exploring these ideas, to question your own assumptions, and to engage in respectful dialogue with those who hold different views.
Remember, this deep dive was just a starting point. There's a whole universe of information and perspectives out there waiting to be discovered. So keep digging, keep questioning, and most importantly, keep an open mind. Until next time, happy exploring.